You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Thomas, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, E.G. Dillard. A.G. Dillard is a road paving company who created a road, paved a connector road in an apartment complex that was being constructed in Albemarle County. They completed the road, they didn't get their retainage payment, and they sued the general contractor for $90,000. General contractor counterclaimed, and ultimately the court found in favor of A.G. Dillard and dismissed the counterclaim. A.G. Dillard went to collect on that counterclaim. Went to collect on that $90,000 judgment, and perhaps by no surprise, found that not only was the cupboard there, to stretch the analogy, it was as though the cupboard wasn't even there anymore.
It had been moved.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, it had been taken down out of the house and moved over to the neighbor's house, and I think that analogy is now stretched farther than it can go. Because when debtors' interrogatories were done and subpoenas were issued, bank records were produced, but what they revealed was that right about the time the litigation had really gotten going in February of 2013, Stonehouse Construction, ostensibly an operating general contractor and one who had in fact been apparently doing work, no longer had an operating account. It didn't have a savings account, it didn't have an escrow account, it didn't have any bank accounts at all. Somehow it was managing to do business without being able to take in or dole out a single dollar except possibly in cash, and there was no evidence that it was doing that either. Instead, and full credit to the representative who showed up on behalf of Stonehouse Construction, he admitted that in fact they were simply engaging in what I am calling a check forwarding scheme. Stonehouse Construction would do the work, the customer, homeowner, whomever it was, would pay the money, Stonehouse would take the check and it would pass it off to a related entity defendant. And there are a series of them, they're the defendants in this case. But importantly, all of them, the complaint alleges, are controlled by a single individual, Robert Hauser. Now, whether that's done in his own name or whether that's done in the name of a wholly owned entity, Darby Holdings, LLC was one that was identified, Bonstone Ventures, yet another. The fact of the matter is that the money would come in and it would just pass right on through to a related entity defendant, and somehow none of the profit ever came back to Stonehouse Construction. And the complaint alleges the way in which that happened. The money would pass on, other companies within that family would bill for the work done by their employees, because of course Stonehouse Construction had no employees either. It couldn't, because how could it pay them? Payroll taxes, it would need a bank account for that. So that money would be...
We're actually here on the trial court sustaining of a demur. And of course what you're talking about is proof now, rather than allegations. The trial court in the written statement of facts in lieu of a transcript actually says why the demur was sustained, and it would be, I think, helpful for you to address your response to that. With respect to count one, the trial court said that the complaint did not identify with specificity the targets of the veil-piercing action. I've read your complaint.
Yes, sir.
I think I disagree with the trial court, but you need to tell
yes,
us
sir.
Why that's wrong.
Yes, sir. Well, the first, not the first paragraph, because that identifies the plaintiff, but paragraphs 2 through 9, spell out the parties, the defendants who were involved in this case. It identifies who they are, and by no coincidence, all of them, or most of them, either start with Stonehouse or Bonstone as the first word in the name of the corporation. And then paragraph 8 alleges the relationship that all of them have to each other. Robert M. Hauser is a resident of Virginia. On information and belief, Robert Hauser, or an entity controlled by him, such as Darby Holdings, so a wholly owned LLC, is a member and or manager of each of Stonehouse and each of the related entity defendants. And that establishes conclusively the web that basically puts Mr. Hauser at the center and all of the entities around him. He, or a wholly owned LLC, which for purposes of this analysis I would posit is irrelevant.
Let me ask you a question. Can you pierce the corporate veil of an LLC because of the actions of a manager as opposed to a member?
I think you can when the unity is such that they are acting as an alter ego. If you were unable to allege in good faith that, say, Mr. Hauser was a member of a particular company, but he was a manager, You knew he was the one controlling the actions of the LLC, and the LLC was paying his personal debts, for instance, like paying his mortgage, as we have allegations in here that was doing so. I think that would be the sufficient unity of control, but I don't know that it matters for purposes of this analysis, because the complaint alleges a member and or manager, and certainly taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiff given the dismissal on Demur, the complaint alleges that he or his wife or an entity controlled by him are the ones who have beneficial ownership of all of the entities who are involved in what's here. And that shows up.
Why don't you just say who the members of the various entities are? I mean, isn't that on record with the SEC?
It can be, but it is not necessarily. And with respect to these, we weren't able to locate it. Certainly, I would have.
You weren't able to locate it with the State Corporation Commission?
I'm hesitant to, because it's not in the record here as to exactly all of the things I did to try and determine who specifically the members were, what the Mr. Ball, who appeared for the debtor's interrogatories, told me about the membership, because they aren't actually alleged in the complaint. Suffice it to say that this was the extent of what the plaintiff could allege in good faith, given the discovery available to a creditor as opposed to a litigant. Right? The discovery available to a creditor is far more limited than it is to a litigant, and the ability to discover information about parties against whom you do not have a judgment is essentially nothing. There is essentially no right to ask for ownership documentation about another company when you have a judgment against this company over here. Once you file to pierce the corporate veil and you become a litigant, this information now becomes relevant in a way that it's not when all
you're doing is... Unless you get kicked out on demur.
That is exactly right. And so instead...
So you need to produce the information, but you can't get the information because you got booted out on demur. So catch 22.
Counsel, let me take Justice Goodwin's question and ask it from a different direction, since the record is limited. Based upon your knowledge of the Code of Virginia and the processes of the State Corporation Commission, of which we can take judicial notice, are all the members of an LLC required to be disclosed in the public filings of the State Corporation Commission?
That is a much better question than my answer. They are not.
Okay.
And in fact, I'm not aware of a requirement to disclose any members.
You only disclose the manager?
Yes, sir. And in fact, if a corporation is incorporated by an attorney, I'm not certain that there's a requirement to disclose even that much. You only have to disclose the incorporator, which can just be a member of the Virginia State Bar.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel.
Counsel, did you ask for any discovery at the time you filed the Pearson complaint?
I did not, no, Your Honor.
In theory, you could have, of course, and the rule now, as amended, says that there's no automatic bar to discovery going forward because the demur is present.
That is correct. Part of the reason was because, it turned out erroneously, I believe that the allegations in this complaint were more than sufficient to establish the interrelationship between the parties, which is absolutely necessary, and then facts which supported allegations of alter ego and all of the other requirements to show that piercing the corporate veil would be an appropriate remedy. Not that I had proved it beyond all shadow of a doubt, but that the facts here taken in the light favorable to the plaintiff were sufficient to allow the case to go into discovery. Piercing the corporate veil is a disfavored remedy, and I'm not here to argue that it shouldn't be. But it's a fact-specific one. The court has been very clear that there are no bright-line rules about when it is or is not appropriate. It depends on the facts of the case, which is the purpose of discovery. To overcome a demur, you simply need to allege enough to show that it's certainly more than plausible that if the facts are developed in line with the allegations, that it would be an appropriate remedy. And I believe that has been established here in the complaint, and for purposes of count one, that is why we believe the trial court was in error in dismissing count one.
Well, piercing the corporate veil may be a disfavored remedy, but operating an elaborate shell game in order to defeat your creditors is a disfavored business practice.
Yes, sir. And this court has said, under remarkably similar circumstances in the CF Trust case, that this almost this exact scheme is sufficient to allow an action, or in that case, a judgment, for piercing the corporate veil to go forward. And I would simply note, to the extent it was not already there, before the court, that in CF Trust, in which this court answered a certified question from the Fourth Circuit, Barry Peterson, the quote-unquote bad guy in that particular circumstance, was doing the exact same thing. He was having one of his management companies overcharge other of his operating entities, having that money go directly to the management company, and then having the management company pay all of his personal expenses. In that case, this court said, no, that's certainly enough to justify the remedy of veil piercing, and those are remarkably similar to the allegations here. The second error that we believe the trial court committed, and I do believe it is a matter of first impression before this court, is this question of what are you required to plead, what are you required to allege in order to move forward on an action for fraudulent conveyance? And at the risk of oversimplifying it, I think it comes down to a very simple question of whether or not fraudulent conveyance requires you to plead to the same level as fraud and defamation, where you have to plead, you know, an actual defamation being a case, who said it, where they said it, to whom they said it, what they said, the date on which they said it, the specifics of the statement. Fraud necessarily plead with specificity. Or whether or not for fraudulent conveyance, because it does not require proof of actual fraud to sustain an action for fraudulent conveyance, it is sufficient to allege the scheme, the circumstances under which the fraudulent conveyances occurred, and outline the parties involved, generally the actions taken, the manner in which the conveyances were made, and then the facts which show that they were, for purposes of 5580, fraudulent, by which I mean made to delay, hinder, or defraud creditors. And as far back as 1857, this court has said, when the General Assembly uses or like that, it means in the disjunctive. So a conveyance made to hinder or delay creditors, but made without any intent to defraud, is still a conveyance which may be unwound under 5580 if, at the time, for instance, the grantor is insolvent, if there are the other badges of fraud which indicate that it is made for some relatively improper purpose, even if not fraudulent. And a perfect example, I think, of that would be if I had a number of judgments against me, which, unless I'm missing something, I don't, and my wife finds out about them, and she says, you know, if you end up going into the poorhouse, I'm not going to stay with you, and I don't want to get kicked out of our house. We just built a nice new house. She says, I don't want to leave. So unless you title the house in our name together as tenants by the entirety, I'm leaving you. And I say, well, I can't get divorced at the same time I'm fighting off judgments. Absolutely, sweetheart, I'll do it. And so I transfer the name from my, transfer the house from my name alone into our names as tenants by the entirety. I'm not doing that to defraud anybody in this particular circumstance. But if I'm insolvent at the time I do it, and if that transfer of the sole asset that I have has the effect of hindering or delaying my creditors, then under 5580, it can absolutely be unwound. It can also be unwound under 5581, but those aren't mutually exclusive remedies. And that's what we have here. I think there are also sufficient allegations to show the necessary badges of fraud by which the court could infer fraudulent intent, and again, given where we are, should have inferred fraudulent intent in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. But we think that was the second error committed by the trial court, and for those reasons, we would ask the court to reverse as to the dismissal of count two as well. Unless there are any further questions, I'll yield the balance of my time.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.